So I was asked to suggest readings and to sort of pick two topics, and the ones that I've settled on involve Plato, a text that I distributed today for today from Plato's Laws, and the other from Augustine, a bit from the City of God and a bit from one of Augustine's letters. And the theme of this session is what led me to do that: faith, reason, and the state. And I want to make a kind of just an introductory remark about that before I say a little bit about Plato. And that is this: we've got sort of three things there: faith, reason, and the state, and how that relates to Plato and Augustine is complicated. Okay, so reason, clearly we have that with Plato, one of the greatest and first philosophers in the Western tradition, but not faith there, but simply reason. And in the case of Augustine, we have faith and reason, but it's the primacy of faith and that aspect of it that we look to in Augustine. But we have both there because of the influence of philosophy on Augustine, especially Platonic and Neoplatonic philosophy. It's the third bit that's most problematic, however, because there's no state in our sense of the term for either one of them. That term state, which we associate with the political communities that are characteristic of modern times, really since the 16th century, didn't exist for either Plato or Augustine. Plato's writing in the context of the classical Greek polis, which is a very different kind of political community, far smaller, internally less diverse, and less complicated from an institutional perspective, and quite distinctive. But also Augustine, who lived in an empire, but an empire that was quite far flung, and again, quite different from a modern centralized national state. So that's going to influence what I say in lots of different respects. Nevertheless, there is something that comes out of these three notions and that unites Plato and Aristotle, and that is this larger and deeper question of the relationship of political life to the best kind of human life. How one relates the context of political life in which people live to the best kind of human life one can live. And that relationship is really problematic for both of them in a way that's symbolized by two texts I want to sort of just quote at the beginning. And one is from Plato's Laws, which is the text that I suggested. And there's a passage in the seventh book of the Laws, which is, to my mind, one of the most important in the whole book, maybe the most important, that occurs when the institutional part of the book is just unfolding. And the main speaker there, the Athenian stranger, says that when you're beginning to build a ship, and so he's the ship of state analogy here, you have to sketch the shape of the ship and outline by lying down the keels. I'm trying to distinguish the outline of ways of life as they accord with characteristics of souls, and thus really lying down their keels, investigating in the correct way what device we should use and what characteristics we should at any time incorporate if we're going to be carried through this voyage of existence on the best way of life. Of course, the affairs of human beings are not worthy of great seriousness, yet it is necessary to be serious about them, and this is not a fortunate thing. But since we're here, if somehow we would carry out the business in some appropriate way, it would perhaps be a well-measured thing. And he goes on and says a bit more, but when he finishes this bit, his interlocutor, a Spartan, an elderly Spartan man named Megalus, says, "Stranger, you are belittling our human race in every respect." And the Athenian then says, "Don't be amazed, Megalus, but forgive me, for I was looking away toward the god and speaking under the influence of that experience when I said what I did just now. So let our race be something that's not lowly then, if that is what you cherish, but worthy of a certain seriousness." So that political life, worthy of a certain seriousness, he says, but not complete. And the other text I want to mention from Augustine, very brief, from the De Civitate Dei, the City of God, Book 5, Chapter 17, a famous passage from Augustine. As far as this mortal life is concerned, which is spent and finished in a few days, what difference does it make under what rule a man lives who is soon to die, provided only that those who rule him do not compel him to do what is impious and wicked? And in both cases, what you have there is politics looked at from the perspective of the best kind of life, a kind of transcended perspective, but in different ways, that puts politics in a kind of perspective. Now that's just a kind of introductory remark about both, and now I want to talk a little bit about the laws. And of course, you can't talk about Plato's laws without talking about the Republic. And I'm used to speaking about the relationship between the laws and the Republic in about 75-minute blocks, but I'm going to compress that. Often in the history of political philosophy, the usual view is that you've got these two works and they're different. So it must be that Plato changed his mind. I mean, he wrote the Republic at one stage in his life. He wrote the Laws much later. He wrote the Republic when he was perhaps middle-aged, a little healthier, a little happier, a little more psychologically well-balanced and optimistic. He wrote the Laws when he was elderly and cynical and senile, perhaps even. Some people have suggested that. It's a rather different kind of work. That's not my view. I don't think they're really that different. They're different dialogues and they have different circumstances, but I don't think there's a different teaching. And I think, again, if we had more time, I could explain this in more detail, but to put it very briefly, the Republic, I would say, is not really about politics. It's about philosophy. And what you find in the Republic is a kind of Socratic account of the relationship between the philosophical and political life, which could even be described as a kind of Socratic anti-politics. It shows the difference, the distance between the philosophical life as the highest kind of life and the political life as a kind of necessary life, but one that can never measure up to the demands of philosophy. And so there's a basic issue here, which I think is at the heart of Plato's political philosophy. The issue is about the relationship between philosophy as the highest kind of human life and political life as a necessary form of life for human beings. To put it in a slightly different way, it's about the relationship between truth and politics. The laws, which Plato wrote certainly later in his life because it was somewhat unfinished, found at his death, unpublished during his lifetime, is far more political in the ordinary sense of the term than the Republic is, very political, but also, as many readers have observed, very pious. There's a lot about religion in the Laws, and there's very little about that in the Republic. And the text that I recommended that I think was sent out was the 10th book of the Laws, which is really quite famous, a very famous part of the Laws. It contains the most elaborate philosophical theology, you might say natural theology, that was constructed in antiquity prior to Aristotle and Plotinus, and even more elaborate, I think, than any single thing you find in Aristotle, although on the whole, Aristotle probably has more to say about it. But certainly prior to that time, there's nothing more extensive than the 10th book of the Laws, which famously provides quite detailed arguments for the existence of the gods. But what's interesting about the 10th book of the Laws is that it's not the only thing about religion in the Laws. In fact, you read the book carefully, and what you find is that the city that Plato discusses in the Laws has two religions, not one, but two. And one religion, you might say, is a kind of civil religion, the religion of the city, and it involves temples and gods and sacrifices and festivals, and all of the things that anybody who has studied the history of ancient Greek religion would expect to find in a 4th century BC city. But then there's also this, one wants to call it a philosophical religion in the 10th book that is grounded in three propositions, that the gods exist, that they care about human affairs, and that they cannot be bought off for bad conduct with sacrifices and prayers. And those three propositions are mentioned in the Republic as well as wrongheaded opinions about the gods, but they're just mentioned there. In the laws, there's quite an elaborate account of those principles. And it's fairly clear that the reason those principles are defended and the reason that they have to be defended in the laws is because they're a kind of necessary religious architecture in which the moral life has its intelligibility. So that the kind of conduct that is according to nature, that is naturally right, is understood in part by reference to these propositions about the gods, and especially the first one, which really concerns not simply the existence of the gods, but the priority of soul to body, the priority of the spiritual, one might say, to the material, and to the moral impossibility of reducing the moral or the spiritual simply to the physical. I mean, that's really crucially, I think, what Plato is concerned with there. Now, those propositions are argued for in the 10th book, that the gods exist, that they care about human affairs, and that they cannot be bribed, you might say. And so they're propositions, but should we say that they're doctrines exactly? Well, they're not too dogmatic. They're rather general, and at one point in the text, there's a nice formulation in which the Athenian stranger who's arguing for those propositions is explaining, he's making an argument for the first one, in fact, and he repeatedly says, if this is the case, and if this is the case, and if this is the case, and if this is the case, such as to suggest a number of hypothetical conclusions that are conditioned in a way that leaves quite a lot of the argument open to examination. So they are propositions, but they're not all that dogmatic in the end. Now, in addition to the propositions, however, there's something else, and this is one of the reasons that the laws has something of a bad reputation in the history of political philosophy, and that is, if people publicly criticize or refuse to believe these propositions, they can be prosecuted for impiety. And many people have thought, aha, there it is. As an old man, Plato not only ceased to be Socratic philosophically, he became an enemy of Socrates. And he would have been one of the jurors who voted to make Socrates guilty in the Athenian court in 399 BC. I think that too is not quite right, in part because if a person happens to be prosecuted for these crimes, the punishment that he has is to be confined for a certain period of time with a very funny group of individuals that Plato calls the Nocturinos Sulagos, or the Nocturnal Council, which is made up of a lot of the magistrates and officials of the city and their aides and advisors and this sort of thing, which is to say that if you wind up getting convicted of heresy or impiety in this city, what happens to you is that you have to spend 5 years locked up in conversation with the most interesting people in town. Who knows what the outcome of those conversations might be. What's expected of you at the end of that 5 years is that you moderate yourself in such a way as not to undermine the city's moral life. What you wind up continuing to believe, however, is not altogether specified. And so I think part of what Plato is intending by proposing those three propositions and discussing them in the way that he does is not at all anti-Socratic. On the contrary, it invites a kind of philosophical speculation. It invites the citizens of this city to reflect on the philosophical questions associated with the existence and the nature of the gods in a way that would have been extraordinary for any city at that time. And so it's really quite a remarkable piece of the account. So we don't have, as I said at the beginning, we don't have faith here in Plato's laws. We have reason of a sort, a kind of open-ended philosophical reason about the transcendent context of the city in the life of philosophy as directed towards knowledge of the highest things, the gods, and a kind of attempt, insofar as it's possible, to reconcile the city with reason, to reconcile the political life with the life of reason. But I think we have every reason to doubt that that reconciliation is altogether successful. It's the best Plato could do. But if it were altogether successful, then it seems to me we wouldn't have the very interesting statement in the Laws, not in the piece that I handed out, but in another part of the Laws, 8:17a through d, in which the Athenian stranger describes the city that's been constructed there as the truest tragedy, as the truest tragedy, which I think is a kind of indication that from Plato's perspective, this tension between the highest kind of life and the political life is ultimately one of those problems that you don't solve. The best that you can do is to manage it, to attempt to manage it in a certain way that is ultimately limited and not altogether satisfactory. And that in the end is the point for Plato. There is this fundamental problem between this best way of life and the political life that leads to a sense of limitation, moderation, you might say, on the aims of the city, but partly in the interest of allowing that highest kind of human life to go forward. But the tension between the two is ineliminable.